Kimberly Guilfoyle is one of my favorites, former prosecutor, a lawyer, of course, longtime broadcast journalist, author of a book that, quite frankly, I think everybody should read. My mother read it, told me to read it. It's called Making the Case, How to Be Your Own Best Advocate. And now she has a senior leadership position with the Trump campaign, highly, highly visible, of course. And Kimberly, thank you so much. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Great to be on your podcast.
So, Kimberly, I just want to tell everybody when I first noticed you, it was, let's see, I saw a picture of you in a magazine. It was a very curious case. You were a lawyer, and it was about, let's see, a dog owner, and the dog mauled somebody. But there were just two things. Number one, it was extremely unique, and there you were. I mean, let's face it, you're very beautiful, and you were, I think it was People Magazine or something like that. How big a deal was that in your life? How did that change everything? I knew you were already established, but that seemed to put you on a national map in a new kind of way.
Yeah, it really did. It's an interesting observation because I was working as a prosecutor in the San Francisco District Attorney's Office, and I had just left the LADA's office, come back to San Francisco, and was prosecuting career criminal cases, and also was head of the trial division, the misdemeanor unit, supervising all the attorneys. But I was also volunteering and doing the animal abuse cases and filing those, and a lot of them that were coming to a felony level. So that combination and trying homicides, and this case happened, and it was a woman by the name of Diane Whipple, and she was a star lacrosse player and a coach at Moraga University in the Bay Area. Great human being. She was living in Pacific Heights in an apartment building, very nice apartment building, with her girlfriend that worked, I believe, at Morgan Stanley at the time. And there were two lawyers that were living there, Noel and Noller, Marjorie Noller and Bob Noel. And they were actually representing inmates in the California Department of Corrections. And in particular, they were representing this one inmate, Mr. Schneider, at the Pelican Bay State Prison, which is at the time maximum security prison. And this person was in what's called the SHU, the Secure Housing Unit. So it's, you know, for the most dangerous, you know, notorious criminals. And as it turns out, when this case happened, this poor woman was mauled to death in her own apartment building when she was going home after working for the day and bringing some groceries home to make a dinner. And literally her keys were in the door and she wasn't able to get in her apartment when she was attacked by these two Presa Canario dogs, Bane and Hera. And it was from, dog of war kennels that these inmates were running out of Pelican Bay State Prison. So it was members of the Aryan Brotherhood selling dogs, like protection dogs, to guard methamphetamine labs in Southern California to the Mexican mafia, if you can believe this. And I uncovered all of this through search warrants and research and all of the above, because I said to myself, wait a second, what is going on with these dogs? They mauled this woman. Why were these dogs being kept in an apartment building in San Francisco by these two lawyers? Well, it turns out lawyers took the dogs that belonged actually to this inmate. He was running obviously an illegal business that I exposed. And it was just a real, really sad case. The poor woman fought for her life. Like I said, she was a champion athlete. The dogs attacked her. Marjorie Noller, the female attorney, was actually home at the time and had the dogs. And there was evidence to show she sort of just let the dogs, you know, loose. And there was some antagonism between Noller and this woman and her partner at the time. And so it was just interesting because there was sort of reports in the building that we found out later that the dogs had been aggressive and tried to attack people in the building, but everyone was intimidated by these two lawyers and these dogs. I mean, they have like a prehistoric gait. They're sort of a mix between, you know, a bull mastiff and a pit bull. They were used to fight bulls in Spain. So they're illegal in so many places. And somehow they brought them here, were, you know, breeding them, like I said, for protection dogs, et cetera. And they ended up taking these two dogs and they would walk around, you know, San Francisco. And it was just like a menacing sight. And I uncovered there were 37 prior incidents that people didn't want to talk about because they were too intimidated by them. With the dogs showing aggression? They weren't properly socialized, all of the above. So rewind back to when she comes home that night and they attack her. And the poor woman was trying to crawl to get away from her apartment, was at the end of the hallway, to the elevator to escape, to get in it, to get away from the dogs. Marjorie Knoller went back in her apartment, let this woman get attacked and mauled to death. She had 76 discrete and defined areas of injury all over her body. The only place was the top of her head that wasn't bitten, or injured. And this is from, the autopsy. When I tried the case, I had the medical examiner in San Francisco on the stand for about 3.5 hours, just going through the extent of injuries and the time it took, for this to happen, and that Marjorie Knoller just let this happen, closed the door and essentially let this woman die. And I was able to prove that. So we took it to the grand jury ultimately and put a second degree implied malice murder charge in front of the grand jury. It had never been done before. It was precedent-setting case in the United States of America, and still is, the law for second-degree implied malice murder, that they acted in conscious disregard of a known risk that the dogs were dangerous and that it was likely to cause great bodily injury or death. So we made the argument that this was akin to having like a loaded weapon, like throwing a loaded gun, in a crowded hallway. What's the likelihood that someone would be injured or killed or die, right? So we made that argument to the jury. It ended up being persuasive, especially having all these witnesses come to the stand to say what happened. I subpoenaed all the records at all the different vets in San Francisco because he would take, the dog to different vets to try and not have everything at one place. And in fact, I showed that the male attorney, Robert Noel, actually had his own finger severed off by the male dog, Bane. And had to have it surgically reattached. That's how aggressive these dogs were. And there was one witness account where Robert Noel was dragged across Fillmore Street in San Francisco by this dog, like a human sled. And this is a big guy, like 6'3", pretty heavy, et cetera. That's how strong and aggressive these dogs were. They had mandibles the size of like lions. Now at the scene, the male dog was shot by the officers that responded. Two female officers were first on the scene when the 911 calls came out and they had to put the dog down. The female dog, Hera, was still loose, and the dogs were covered in blood. I'm sorry if this is graphic, but this is what was going on at the time. And it was just a horrific sight. And I was on this detail. And remember, at the time, pagers were, I got a page to my pager letting me know that there had been an officer involved, situation and shots fired and an animal case. So I rolled out to the scene, and it was just, horrific. And I knew that this was not something, out of the ordinary. There was something very wrong here, what the dogs had done, that they weren't properly socialized. And then it turns out, yes, in fact, they were trained to be aggressive and to kill and to attack. So it then we had to have an aggressive dog hearing for the female dog, and she had to be put down because once you have somebody that actually, kills a human being like that, that dog is no longer going to be able to be around, human beings, et cetera, and poses a grave danger and risk. So it was a highly publicized case. You're right, it became national, then international, BBC, Sky News, everybody covering it. And from there, then we obtained convictions. I didn't oppose the change of venue. I tried it with my co-counsel, Jim Hammer, from the DA's office. It was at the time Terrence Hallinan was the head DA. And I had just left LA, like I told you. So I didn't oppose the change of venue. I wanted to have a fair trial. I wanted to be upheld on appeal because it was a novel case. And we moved the case to Los Angeles. The head judge, evaluated the different places where we could have security, especially since it involved the Aryan Brotherhood. They ended up putting a contract out on me to have me killed.
Jeez.
I did not remove myself from the case because that would just be passing the buck to somebody else. So it was, it was very fascinating. A lot of, legal issues, especially trying two attorneys. They would mark attorney-client privilege and all their communications with these inmates that they were representing in lawsuits against the California Department of Corrections. So we had search warrants served at their house, had it be reviewed by what's called a special master because they were attorney-client, letters. I also found out they ended up adopting this inmate. It was a very bizarre love relationship that they had with him. You can't even make this stuff up, but obviously it captured the national interest, as you've mentioned. And then that's when I got six offers to, work in television. I ended up accepting my own show at Court TV during the day. I am exclusive to ABC, Good Morning America, and World News Tonight at ABC, and then CNN exclusive to them prime time for Anderson Cooper and Larry King. and then eventually after a few years, then going and working at Fox for 12 years. So it's been incredible. Now I work for the President of the United States as senior advisor of the campaign and national finance chair. So there you go,
It is
American dream.
totally wild. Wait, real quick
And
on
that was
that.
while I was first lady of San Francisco, by the way.
Ah, so we can talk about that.
Yes,
You were married to the
to
present
Gavin
governor
Newsom,
of
yeah.
California, Gavin Newsom, and it seems like you guys are on great terms from what I can tell, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it's been a very helpful, I think, to facilitate a very strong, good working relationship between the governor of California and the president of the United States. And so I think it just goes to show when you have that communication and, you know, a conduit that's helpful for that, that we can achieve things. So they actually have a very good, you know, cooperative working relationship. And I think, you know, the country benefits from that, California benefits from that. I think you've seen that, you know, you don't really see disparaging comments, et cetera. They're quite almost, you know, complementary of one another. I mean, one time my Gavin said, promises made, promises kept, about President Trump, being honest that he's, you know, honored everything that he told Gavin, you know, the governor, that he would do. So it's been a fascinating, you know, situation to watch.
So,
It's, you know, I'm all for good government.
real quick on the dog case, did they go to jail? You got a conviction, they went to jail. Where are they now, those two people?
Well, so the wife who was present at the time was convicted, and she ended up getting a sentence that had a potential life top, but I think it was like 15 years to life. And so she served until recent and was eight, you know, now I believe is out. And I know that was coming up to the probation, excuse me, the prisoner like pardon board, not pardon board, the parole board in California. And then the husband was convicted and also charged of a lesser, you know, crime. And he did his time. And now I don't know where they are, but not that I want to keep in touch with them, put it
Right.
that way.
When you joined, when you became a prosecutor, at that
It's
time,
been almost 20 years.
20 years since that case,
Just about.
you graduated from law school in the 90s. I'm just curious,
Yes.
when you finished law school, did you have a plan, a map, a roadmap? I mean, back then there was such a thing as a celebrity lawyer, and there were plenty of commentators on television. Was that in the back of your mind? You did a little bit of modeling, I think, around that time as well. Like, you
I
know.
did. I paid, well, I paid for law school modeling, doing, you know, a wide variety of modeling. Yes, lingerie mine, but also beauty, sports, for all of the above, meaning, you know, face modeling, all of the above. And that was really great because it was able to help, you know, pay for my education as a means to an end. And I was very lucky to have, you know, that opportunity. And it also helped really, I think, you know, develop a maturity in me, a sense of poise and confidence. And you know, just a business sense as well, being in an industry like that, and you know, good head on my shoulders. And then I went to law school. I was also working in the district attorney's office in San Francisco, and that was a wonderful experience. And working in some of the different trial divisions, I was able to try my first felony case as an intern under supervision of one of the homicide prosecutors there. So I always knew that I wanted to do something in public service like that. I absolutely loved working and being a prosecutor and was able to achieve tremendous things. And thanks be God, get, you know, great awards, et cetera, and undefeated Los Angeles and San Francisco. And just loved being a victim's advocate for those people who don't have, you know, a voice. And then I went on from there because the dog Mullen case happened, and I had sort of, you know, really achieved. I finished the complex caseload that I had. I kept, you know, getting, you know, the offers and interest from talent agents, et cetera, because I was doing a lot of the television nationally, as you recall, for the case. And so that's how it kind of all came to be. And I'm always one, and I talk about it in my book that I know your mom told me that she read, that is, you know, there's different chapters in life, and you can't be afraid to open that door and go through a new change and a new experience and push yourself to be able to try to achieve different things. And I've done that my entire life. And so this was no exception. And against all odds, I sort of like uprooted, even though I was still First Lady of San Francisco. And I just thought, okay, you know, this relationship is going in a way that, you know, I feel that this is the right thing, you know, for me as a person. And I went and, you know, moved to New York. And it was, you know, scary, of course, at the time, but wow, how rewarding and exhilarating and interesting. and fascinating, and what a ride that it's been. And once again, then taking an opportunity, became vice chairwoman of America First, the president's super PAC, which was a phenomenal job. And then now, and this is over the past, what, 2.5 years, and now being, like I said, senior advisor and national finance chair for the president. And here we are, not even what, a week out between for our next election.
It's wild. Look, I want to ask you real quick about a little bit about TV, and then we'll get to the campaign. And I don't know if you remember, but I met you for the first time at the Soho House with a person named Serena Torrey, and
That's correct.
you were both extremely nice. And I remember reading a line that you told a newspaper, a magazine, and it was about Gavin, quite frankly, and it was an amicable situation, and the line was, "There was too much ambition on one mattress."
Oh, that was so funny. Yeah, that was actually a line that somebody said about us, that, too much ambition, too much power on one
Oh,
mattress.
I'm
She
sorry, but
loved
did
him in that
you
poetic
embraced it
way.
though? You like you thought it was like apropos, or was it not
I
nice?
thought it was a, it was sort of like clever, meaning like he was the mayor, and here I was, the DA in a very, high position. A lot of people wanted me to run for office later in San Francisco, either run for mayor or run for DA. So I see what they're saying. They're like, this was a power couple. They did, there was an article about us written by a woman, Nancy Collins, who's a phenomenal writer for Harper's Bazaar magazine, that said the new Kennedys, and it's been referenced, many times years later, sort of an iconic piece that, yeah, we were this power couple in San Francisco. And now keep in mind, I've always been registered Republican since I was 18 years of age. So, this first thing I did, and so I've always been conservative, and Gavin will attest to that. So it's sort of no surprise that I ended up, where I am. I've always had an affinity for politics and communications and fundraising. I did all of that for Gavin. I headed up his, transition team, helped him run, do six different campaigns with him. I was the head of his finance committee as well, and worked in a lot of different political campaigns in the West Coast. So I sort of have that understanding. And I think it's also something that was beneficial to me because I had such close proximity and positioning in the Democrat Party in terms of working with him. But at the time, he was the most moderate person running for mayor of San Francisco, and he had multiple terms on city council, and he's a small businessman, and had a lot of the same values that some of the more moderate or centrist conservatives have. But I think that it just goes to show you how far left the Democrats have come. It's just unrecognizable and untenable when you think about it, because it's now just bordering on socialism, and communism, quite frankly. So it's just been interesting to watch, American politics front row seat, back then, and then of course covering news for so many years, and then now, was working as a journalist for the last election in 2016. In fact, was the first person to support President Trump at Fox News. And everybody often remarks about that to say that he would win. The president's been my friend for 15 years, and I know the measure of the man, his skill set and his capability, his work ethic, and his perseverance. And now the world knows and sees it. So it's been fascinating, to watch.
One thing on television, you are not afraid to have fun on TV. And a lot of
True.
people on television, men and women, they just take themselves extremely seriously. And you know the range. You know, like, the envelope for television work is much bigger than I think a lot of people on television realize. You can go there and you can do things and you can have fun. And it's compelling to watch. Bottom line, on TV, there are frustrations involved. Was it fulfilling for you overall? Did you enjoy it? Every job has its downside. Overall, you and television, bottom line is what?
I love television. I think, it's such a great medium to communicate and reach people. And for me, making the transition was quite easy because I had been a trial lawyer, and handling everything up through death penalty cases. I argued all my cases, without notes, and would just get up there and connect and pick the juries and just understand people. So when it came down to television, I wasn't like something where, oh my gosh, how do I do this? It just came very natural and very easy for me. I enjoy television a lot, and it's, fascinating to me. I think there's incredible journalists and personalities out there, you being one of them, that really understand how to connect with people and be able to kind of sort of jump through the screen. It's like I used to be able to connect, you know, with my, you know, jurors and look them in the eye and present the case and present the facts. And I really wanted to do the same thing every day that, you know, I'm on television. I want to do that same thing where I connect with people. I'm giving them the information. I'm putting them in that front row seat to understand and to be sort of present for whatever it is that I'm describing or talking about or experiencing. So, you know, I enjoy it a lot. I enjoy podcasts. I enjoy, you know, radio, and, you know, I'm excited. I expect to be doing television again, but it has been my great honor to be able to work for the president and to do this. I mean, what a rewarding experience. How fascinating. I have learned and grown, you know, so much seeing all the insides, especially of a presidential campaign and election process. So it's, you know, for me, it's always an evolving process to try to grow and actually expand your horizons, your knowledge base, your experience, your skill set. You know, that to me is always should be very fluid. It's a process that is ongoing. And so, you know, I've accomplished and achieved pretty much everything that I've wanted to in life, but my curiosity remains and my interest and my enthusiasm. I love to work and love to have jobs and, you know, get involved and enjoy people. And it's been really great actually traveling the entire country. Don Jr. and I have done that, and it's been a wonderful experience. We've been in just about every single state, you know, on the road almost 300, you know, days a year. It's been fascinating, and seeing all the different people across the country. And that's why I see the level of enthusiasm, you know, for the president, and the number of people that come out, even when Don and I are doing, you know, rallies or appearances and events, and I do fundraisers all across the country. It's been wow. So I'll be quite surprised, you know, if he doesn't win because of this measure and level of enthusiasm that I see, because the president is very relatable. He understands people. And that's why he was such a superstar on television, too, when you think about it. When you look at The Apprentice and everything else, he's the greatest showman, but he's the hardest worker. So I identify, you know, Don always makes jokes, and Jared says, too, you know, OK, would they understand Kimberly? Like, I don't have hobbies. My hobby is work and winning. So I just, you know, I love to get after it and get it done, you know, because like you could sleep when you're dead, you know.
Yeah, no, it's wild what you're doing, and you're doing it so well. And just wrapping up, you know, a couple of things real quick. One of the reasons why I think you get Trump so much and he gets you is going back to your book, How to Be Your Own Best Advocate. You know, culturally, we're in a place, and we have been for a very long time. I don't know, maybe centuries, but that it's acceptable and preferred that you put yourself down. You know, self-deprecation it's okay. The only people who are allowed to be kind of proud and strong are like professional athletes. Everybody else is not supposed to be that way. And,
right.
You know, Donald Trump is never self-deprecating. I mean, ever. And I don't know, I wonder if all that self-deprecation and all that nasty, negative self-talk we all walk around with, it's time to reevaluate it as a culture. I mean, they call it, call it bragging, or you could call it being your own best friend. You know what I mean? Am I onto something?
Yeah, because you know what? Life is hard enough. People are trying to put everybody else down every single day. If you don't, I was raised this way, okay? To be strong and powerful, especially as a woman and as a young girl. You know, my father was like, you can be and do anything that, you know, that a man can achieve, you can achieve or do it. But anything your brother can do, you can do, and you can do better. I was raised that way. Okay. So I was raised, hey, taking, you know, martial arts and boxing and fighting. You know, I was raised, hey, you want to play soccer? Go and try out for the boys team. If you're good enough, great, you'll make it. If not, my mom told the coach, you know, cut her from the team. I get it. So I don't want anything handed to me. I want to work hard for it. I want to achieve it, but you can't do it if you don't believe in yourself. So when you're sitting there, like putting yourself down and other people, what are you really achieving? I'm not saying about not being humble. That there's a difference. I'm talking about having a self-confidence and an ability to believe in yourself that you can achieve your dreams and not expecting someone else to hand it to you. How do you do that if you're always telling yourself that you can't or that you're not good enough? How do you reconcile that?
So one more thing, like
that's why I wrote the book.
I think it's a real service, and that kind of approach, I hope it catches on and you can see what can be achieved. And Donald Trump is a a role model and should be even more of a role model. That attitude, I think there's so much to it. Norman Vincent Peale, he's spoken openly about his devotion to that man, that philosophy. You weren't on the campaign trail in 2015, 2016, in the
no,
aggressive
just reporting
way.
Right,
on
right,
it. Right, right.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to ask the president, and I didn't because I figured he'd just say, as
in
I would say,
interview,
you know, like, yeah, it was about 2 weeks ago on the phone. But
yep.
What are the crowds like today compared to 4 years ago? And I just want to kick this around with you because you weren't on the campaign trail. I actually wasn't on the campaign trail. I saw the very first rally when he came down the escalator, and it wasn't really a rally. And I sensed that at that time he could win. But what are people telling you who have been there 4 years ago? I guess the crowds, are they bigger? Are they more enthusiastic? With COVID, are they by definition smaller? Are they telling you that there's even more electricity than there was 4 years ago? And
yes, I'm out there. I opened for the president at the pre-program. So this is, I can tell you this, you know, empirically and as a percipient witness, like a direct, you know, eyewitness experiencing this entire thing because I covered it, right? I covered it before in 2016. Yes, now I'm part of it. But I'll tell you, Don Jr. will tell you the same thing. We both are like, wow, the enthusiasm and the number of people coming out. I am telling you that, and he would tell you the same, greater and even more intense than 2016. So, or 2015 leading up to it. That's why I'm having a hard time saying, how does this guy not win and get reelected? And the answer to that is, I believe he is going to win. I believe there are going to be surprises, much like there was in 2016. But if for some reason he doesn't, I really believe it will be because of the problems with the mail-in voting, ballot harvesting, voter fraud, et cetera, that's why we have 42 active cases and lawsuits going on in so many different states to prevent this kind of thing. I mean, they want to, it's illegal. You shouldn't be able to verify a signature on someone voting. Why would you be against that unless you were trying to, you know, cheat? Like, it's insane. Yeah. You know, and now we're going to count ballots and let people turn in ballots 14 days after the election's over in some states. It's nuts.
Well, I have
it's
a
feeling absolutely nuts.
It could be an early election night. I share the same fears, but I do think that there's going to be a surprise, like he's going to win New Jersey, like
oh my
he's
God,
going to
I
win New York.
I just said this to Don last night, and we literally were talking about, you really think so? I said, I'm telling you, and Eric Trump thinks the same thing. We both mentioned New Jersey. In fact, when we were in Florida to a group of donors and supporters, and just, yeah, I think there's going to be surprises like that. That's quite interesting that you say that.
Just heads up, in New Jersey, that's one of the states, I believe, where they've got a pretty new and plenty of mischief opportunities in their mail-in voting program. But on the merits, Donald Trump, I believe, will win New Jersey. So let me just ask you this, and then we'll wrap up. Like, if there is a second term, I kind of see you potentially, you're obviously a great spokesperson, but you also kind of know the mechanics now of government and certainly of law. Just hypothetically, would you go into a position on the other side, like not getting the message out, but actually policy and crafting from cabinet secretary or a sub-cabinet position, just something on the other side, not in communications? Is that because you kind of mastered that? You we know you're good at that. And I think you're good at the other stuff, but you haven't done that in a long time or anything like that, perhaps since you were a prosecutor. Does that intrigue you?
Yeah, look, everything intrigues me, you know, about life. I think it's going to be exciting because there's so many opportunities and so many possibilities. I obviously believe, you know, in public service, having worked, you know, as a prosecutor. I was raised, you know, that way. And I wouldn't rule it out. I can't say that I'm going to do that. I'm not being coy. I can't say that's something that I'm going to do right away. But, you know, let's see what the future, you know, holds. I'm still very fascinated and really interested in media at all levels. And obviously government work and service is a very admirable thing to do, another way to give back. But I also feel that I have given the last, you know, couple years of my life to be able to fight for this country and for the American dream and for the policies that I believe in, to be able to ensure that the president is reelected and that we, you know, take back the House and that we keep the Senate. So we do a lot of advocacy and events on that side as well. So this has been, you know, a battle for the soul of the country, and I've been happy to be a part of it, and we'll see what the future holds.
All right. You're amazing, and keep it up. Kimberly Guilfoyle, my best to Don Jr., and seriously, thank you. Thank you very, very much.
Absolutely. God bless.
Kimberly Guilfoyle, totally cool. I wish you could meet her. I hope you enjoyed that. I love talking to her, and a huge, huge, big future. And we didn't talk about her son, Ronan, who's about to go to high school, I believe. And she's got it all going on, but she works for it. She works for it, works for it, works for it, and is really, really good. So this is the Greg Kelly Podcast, and thank you for listening. You can check out the TV show, Newsmax, at 7 o'clock Monday through Friday, Eastern Time. What else? Okay, if you don't mind, it would mean a lot. Rate and review this podcast, however one does that. I don't think I've ever done that myself, and I feel a little bit guilty because I've listened to a lot of good podcasts. I vow to rate and review others that I like. So thank you very much, and to be continued. See you next time.